Good morning, members. We'll call the meeting of the Environmental Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. First item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. I have a motion to approve. Any questions on that? Representative Torkelson, would you be willing to move the minutes, please?
So moved, Mr. Chair, and move the minutes of the last meeting.
Second on that?
Second.
Don't need it. Okay. And then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Minutes are approved. Second item on the agenda is on the cart where the coffee is. There's a couple of bags of donuts. If you've ever been into northwest Minnesota, there's a small town up there called Strathcona. If you Google Strathcona, you'll find that the population is about 42 people. And the gas station post office cafe is referred to as Paradise. These donuts were made fresh yesterday morning at the Paradise restaurant and cafe, and the ladies there, they know how to make donuts. So help yourself. Anything for the benefit of the group before we get started? I do want to mention we have four session at 10 today, so we will be gaveling out here at 9:50. Gives you time to get over there. I anticipated Representative Hansen's question there, I hope.
Yes, we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, that's sometimes good.
Now we're going to get worried.
Anything else? If not, we're going to do an overview on rulemaking today, and Matt Gehring is here to kind of get things kicked off for us. Well, I don't like saying kicked off sitting next to someone from Wisconsin here, but that's okay. So, Matt, would you introduce yourself for the record, please, and proceed?
Sure. Mr. Chair, my name is Matt Gehring. I'm from the Nonpartisan House Research Department. I staff the Government Operations and Elections Committee, which is why I'm in front of you today, because that committee, as you all know, handles administrative rulemaking issues. So you should have in your packet a set of PowerPoint slides that are up on the screen right now, and you can follow along with your actual handout as we go along. The one thing I'll tell you before we jump into the actual substance is that administrative rulemaking really is a pretty complicated and detailed area of the law, and so what I'm going to give you today is really just a 15-minute kind of crash course in how administrative rulemaking works. There's more content on the slides than I'm actually going to talk about, because I want to be respectful of all of your time and other people to testify today. So if you see something on the slides that I don't talk about, that you have questions about, please feel free to ask as we go along. I'm happy to talk about what our issues are of particular interest to you and the committee. So my plan for today is it's got sort of four parts in this presentation. One is to give you an administrative rulemaking 101, kind of, like I said, a crash course on what the procedure is for adopting administrative rules. Then I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about the opportunities for legislative input. So what role do you all have as legislators and as a legislative committee in the rulemaking process? Then we'll go through a couple scenarios or sort of frequently asked questions from legislators about what happens when you feel like rulemaking is going wrong, so like either you don't like a rule or something happened that you think should have been adopted by rule and wasn't. And then finally, I'm going to give a little sales pitch for a Reviser of Statutes website that has a new feature that you can track the rulemaking process sort of in real time as it goes through the process and kind of see what's happening within the agencies. So the first section of the presentation is just, like I said, is an Administrative Rulemaking 101 kind of overview. And so the first thing we'll start with is, what's a rule? So this is kind of the fundamental question that you all ask when you're talking about rulemaking. What is it that the agencies are doing? So the definition in statute of a rule means every agency statement of general applicability and future effect, including amendments, suspensions, repeals of rules adopted to implement or make specific the law enforced or administered by the agency or to govern its organization or procedure. So that's a lot of legal jargon and just a lot of stuff. So what does that really mean? There are really three things that administrative rules do. One thing that administrative rule might do would be to implement a new law that's been enacted by the legislature by providing additional detail to the law. So you as a legislature might have adopted a specific state policy and allowed the agency to build out that policy with additional technical expertise or technical details that might have been too much to put into a statute. The second thing that the agency might do with a rule is interpret an existing law in a more specific way. So they might build out on some law that you've given them rulemaking authority on to clarify for members of the public how they're going to enforce that law. Or the third thing that an agency might do with an administrative rule is set a procedure that governs the process within the agency for how they conduct their agency's business. An agency is only allowed to adopt an administrative rule if it's authorized to do so by law. This is in Chapter 14. And the legislature, all of you as committee members and as the legislature, have discretion to decide how much rulemaking authority you actually want to grant. And so you could either give a very general rulemaking authority to an agency to let them adopt whatever rules they want to, or you can be very, very specific and direct them to adopt a specific rule that you actually write out in statute and don't give them too much discretion to decide how to interpret that grant of authority. A little bit later in the presentation, I'll give you an example of what those things look like. Agencies are required to submit their what's called a rulemaking docket to all of you by January 15th of each year, so by Sunday, I guess, was the deadline. I saw in the set of handouts that you have for today the rulemaking dockets from both the DNR and the PCA as part of your paper handouts. I presume later in the hearing today you'll hear more about that. So the rulemaking process is really a set of procedures that agencies have to follow before they can adopt a rule. And there are six different ways that a rule might be adopted. And I'm not going to go through all these in excruciating detail, but I'm going to kind of run through them pretty quickly. You can think of the rulemaking process really as, in a sense, it's sort of like a legislative hearing where the agency needs to give notice that they're going to adopt rules. Like you all give notice of a committee hearing. They receive public comments and public testimony. They decide what they're going to write in their rules. And then in some cases, there'll be a public hearing. And there's a variety of other procedures that happen before a rule can actually be adopted and put into force. So the different procedures within each of this list of six sets of procedures vary widely. So the sort of standard procedure, the standard operating procedure for most permanent rulemaking is just referred to as standard permanent rulemaking. This is the most expansive set of procedures that agencies must follow. It also is the set of procedures that takes the longest usually. Under standard rulemaking, public comments have to be solicited at least 60 days prior to an agency actually formally proposing rules, so this is an opportunity for members of the public to send into the agency some ideas that they have for what the rules might be, and then the agency can consider those comments, and then they actually go through the process of drafting the rules. One of the features that you get out of standard permanent rulemaking is a document called the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. This is also referred to as a SONAR. For all of you who are interested in learning more about why an agency is choosing to write the rules the way that it wants to, this SONAR document can be really, really valuable because it's the agency's justification and explanation for why they chose the rules that they did, why the rules are reasonable in their view, and why the rules are needed in their view. And you might disagree with what they say in the SONAR, but at least that's a written document from the agency that explains their thinking on adopting the rule. Public hearings do happen usually in standard permanent rulemaking, but not always. It depends on the amount of controversy with the rule. An agency is allowed to schedule a hearing on their own if they feel like the rulemaking is going to be controversial for one reason or another, or they can choose not to do that. But then there's also the authorization for members of the public to petition for a public hearing on a proposed rule under this process if 25 or more people request it. A somewhat shorter process for rulemaking is called expedited rulemaking. This process still has a public comment period. This is a 30-day public comment period instead of 60 days. So it's a little bit shorter, and it's intended to get the rules through more quickly. You need to specifically authorize expedited rulemaking in statute if that's the process you want an agency to follow. In 2015, all of you authorized expedited rulemaking in a variety of contexts within the Environment and Natural Resources area, including in Chapter 97A, which is the Game and Fish chapter, and 97B and C, which is hunting and fishing. One special type of administrative rulemaking process that's unique to the DNR only is called emergency rulemaking. This is a rulemaking process that the agency uses actually somewhat regularly. This process was enacted in 1995 specific for the DNR, and it provides for a public comment period of 25 days before rules are proposed, and then it provides for review of the rules by the Attorney General. So most other rulemaking procedures go through the Office of Administrative Hearings, but the emergency rulemaking procedures for the DNR go through the AG's office. Emergency rules are effective for 180 days only, and they can be extended one time for an additional 180 days, but then after that they have to be adopted through the normal standard rulemaking process and not through these emergency procedures. Like expedited rulemaking, the use of emergency rulemaking does require your approval, so you need to specifically authorize the agency and statute to use the emergency rulemaking procedures in order to do that. And there are a variety of rules, as I said, that the DNR adopted both in 15 and 16 under this process. Exempt rulemaking is another set of procedures. This is, as we're kind of going through these different procedures, we're getting sort of less and less actual procedure and more exemptions from things that agencies don't have to do to adopt rules. So exempt rulemaking doesn't have any public comment period. There's no statement of need and reasonableness or public hearing in this process. There is review of the proposed rules by the Office of Administrative Hearings to verify that they've complied with the law and whether the agency has established that the rules are needed and are reasonable. Exempt rules are effective for only 2 years, and then after 2 years, they either need to be adopted in a permanent rule or enacted by statute. There is a special sort of subset of exempt rulemaking called good cause rulemaking. Good cause rulemaking allows for the adoption of rules that address serious and immediate threats to public health, health, safety, or welfare, or require an agency to, or as required to comply with a court order that applies to the agency. Good cause exempt rules also can incorporate specific changes directed by statute if there's no interpretation of the law required. In 2015, you all authorized the DNR to adopt good cause rulemaking for a variety of rules, including rules related to personal flotation devices, environmental assessments of recreational trails that are open to ATVs and other motorized vehicles, and then some water use restrictions that would apply if there's a local emergency. So these are all situations where you directed the agency to adopt a specific type of rule, and you actually said in the statute what you wanted the rule to be, and then authorized this good cause exemption so that the agency didn't have to go through the full 6 month or longer process to actually get to the rules effective date. The last type of procedure that is not really a procedure at all, this is just a designation statute that some types of rules are not rules at all. So it might you might hear that the agency has taken some sort of action and think, oh, that seems like a rule. That seems like the kind of thing that they would have to go through the process to get some public comment and get some approval on. But for certain types of things, within Chapter 14, the statute says that these are not a rule. Specific to the environment and natural resources area, these include things like experimental and special management waters that are designated by the DNR, game refuges designated by the DNR, and some of the electronic licensing transaction fees are all designated in statute as not being rules, and so the agency can adopt those without any special process one way or the other. The length of time that it takes an agency to adopt rules really varies pretty widely depending on how complex the rule is and how much controversy there is around the rule. So the rough estimate for each of these procedures I've got listed on this slide here, the standard permanent rulemaking can take from about 6 months to up to 2 years depending on how much controversy there is, whether it's a public hearing or not, and how much staff time is involved. A lot of what we've got on my estimates of time here really depend on how much time it takes to actually figure out what the agency is going to write in the rule and how much staff time they put into doing that. So the timelines are based purely on what's required by the statute. So if you put a calendar together based on the exact deadlines in the statute, you get to these periods of time. So you get from 6 months to 2 years for standard rulemaking. The good cause exempt rulemaking can be done in 4 to 6 weeks if the agency is kind of on the ball and knows what they want to write. And then the emergency DNR rulemaking can take between 6 to 8 weeks in a really efficient process. There are a couple deadlines in the statute for actually completing the rulemaking process. So once you authorize an agency to adopt rules, they have to publish a notice of intent to actually adopt the rules within 18 months of the effective date of that authorization. So if you authorize some sort of rulemaking in this session, the agency would have until roughly the end of 2018 to actually get that process going. And then agencies are required to actually finally adopt their rules within 180 days. That's about 6 months after they receive the final report from the administrative law judge. There's an approval process that rules have to go through the Office of Administrative Hearings where you get this ALJ report. So once the ALJ has reviewed the rules and said they look good and comply with the law, then the agency has to actually go through the process of issuing the final adoption of those rules within 6 months of that report. Adopting rules does carry a cost to agencies. The amount of the cost depends on how complex the rule is and how much controversy there is and how long the process goes on. There's a committee called the Interagency Rules Committee that's made up of rulemaking staff from a variety of different executive branch agencies, and they put together sort of a rubric that gives rough estimates for how much rulemaking costs, and their estimates when they're advising agencies on how much to expect, they say that it costs about $10,000 for a small, non-controversial one- or two-page rule and can cost up to $300,000 for the agency to conduct complex rules that would have a hearing and a variety of back-and-forth procedures with the Office of Administrative Hearings. Most of that cost comes from staff time involved in developing the rule, and also there's some sort of hard costs in the process for publishing notices and sending out notifications to the public, and then using the Office of Administrative Hearings, there's a cost for doing that that gets charged to the agency, and then other staff time, such as consulting with the Attorney General's office and the agency's actual own staff time in working on the rulemaking process.
Mr. Burris, would you hold on for a second, please? Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it appropriate to ask a couple of questions at this point in time?
If we're kind of on a slide.
It relates to the rulemaking.
Specifically on this slide, if you want to do that. Otherwise, I would prefer to wait till the end and come back and do some generic things. But I've got a couple other people on the list, too. Okay. But, Mr. Burris, specific to this slide, your second bullet point. Oops, I'm sorry. Go back one.
The cost.
The bottom one there, the cost. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I called you Burris. I'm Gehring. I'm sorry. The costs include how are those tracked? I mean, is that something that you can answer? How are those tracked within these different entities there? You know, so how do we distribute or account for the $300,000, say?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, the cost I don't think is individually itemized out on a spreadsheet. I think they describe in the fiscal note that if you have some sort of program that's going to have rulemaking associated with it, the fiscal note will say we think the rulemaking associated with this program will cost this amount of dollars. And then I'm not sure, maybe Brad might know better than me, but I think in some fiscal notes it might spell out like exactly what the costs are and who it's being assigned to. But I think more commonly what I've seen is just like a general ballpark estimate of the cost, and then you kind of assume that part of that cost is going to go to the internal agency staff time, part of the cost is going to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, part of the cost is going to go to sending out notices and that sort of thing. I haven't really seen an itemized out list like that too often.
Mr. Higler, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, I think the agencies could probably answer that one a lot better, how they specifically track it.
Thank you. Proceed, Mr. Gehring.
So there are a variety of ways that the members of the public can participate in the rulemaking process, and I've listed them out on this slide here. So the most important thing that if a member of the public was asking me what they could do to know what's going on with rulemaking is I'd tell them to register with the agency that they're interested in. This gets them on the mailing list so that they receive the notices that the agency sends out about different steps in the rulemaking process. Once you're on that mailing list, and that gives you information about when, for example, public hearings are going to be held or when comment periods are open, and then that kind of triggers you to send in your thoughts if you have them. Members of the public can submit, written comments during public comment periods. They can also appear if there's going to be a public hearing on a rule. They can actually appear at the hearing itself and testify. So the hearings that happen at the Office of Administrative Hearings on rulemaking really, like I said at the beginning, are operate a little bit more like a legislative hearing rather than a court hearing. So agency staff will appear and they will explain why they have the rules, why they wrote them the way that they did, and explain to the judge why they think they're needed and are reasonable. And then members of the public and other stakeholders can also testify at that hearing. They can ask questions of the agency staff. They can ask questions of each other and give their perspective on whether a rule is appropriate or not. So that's something that for members of the public, if they're interested in that, that's a way to be involved in the process. In Chapter 14, there's a set of special procedures that apply to certain types of rules, including one section that relates to rules that will cost small businesses or small cities more than $25,000 to comply. So in the rulemaking process, agencies are required to include this calculation within their statement of need and reasonableness or as part of the process they need to certify whether they think that compliance with the rule is going to cost small business or small cities more than $25,000. If the cost exceeds this amount, then individual small businesses or cities can claim a temporary exemption from the rule, and then the temporary exemption would apply to them, so they wouldn't have to comply with that rule until the legislature comes back and actually approves the rule by law. One thing that I would note about this is that there is an exception. There's a couple of exceptions in the law. One that's a little bit relevant to this committee is that there's an authorization for the governor to waive application of this temporary exemption allowance, which is it's a long way of saying that the governor can say this exemption doesn't apply in a specific case. And most recently, in December, the governor did waive application of this allowance in the context of a DNR rule relating to land use and development in the Mississippi River Corridor. This is an authorization for the governor that's been in place since 2005, and this is the second time that he's used it. So in 2015, he waived the small business exception for some DHS rules related to DHS programs, and then this past December, he waived this allowance for the DNR Mississippi River corridor area. So that means that the small businesses that apply for an exception under those rules weren't granted the exception.
And, Mr. Gehring, are small businesses and small cities defined in statute someplace?
Yep, Mr. Chair. So a small business is a business that has 50 or fewer employees, and a small city is a city that has 10 or fewer employees. So the next section of the presentation, I'm just going to talk about what your opportunities are for actually being active as legislators in the rulemaking process and when you can provide your input on what the rule should be. So as a reminder from the earlier slide, an agency is only allowed to adopt rules if they're authorized to do so by law. So this is really like your strongest into the rulemaking process is that you can grant rulemaking authority or you don't have to. So if you choose to not grant authority, then the agency can't adopt rules. As I mentioned also earlier, agency rulemaking authority can be very general. It can be very specific. So this next slide just shows an example of what a general rulemaking authority might be. So this is Chapter 86B. This is a chapter that regulates water safety and the use of watercraft in Minnesota. And what you've got in that chapter is an authorization for the commissioner to adopt and enforce rules necessary to implement this chapter. So you basically gave a broad branch of authority for the commissioner to decide whatever rules are necessary to help regulate water safety and watercraft use. You've authorized the commissioner to adopt those rules. A more specific grant of authority is an example that comes from Chapter 84 that relates to rulemaking regarding snowmobile use. So you can see here this is a more specific type of grant of rulemaking authority where you've listed out four specific things that could be the purposes of the rules that are adopted by the commissioner. And in Clause 4 there is an example of something that's really specific that probably is a little bit too technical for legislative time. So what you're doing is requiring the commissioner of DNR to adopt uniform sign standards that are used across the state when necessary to control or regulate the use of snowmobiles on trails. So that might be something that you could put in statute if you wanted to, but it also has a technical aspect that is maybe a little bit too detailed for what you would normally put in statute. So instead, you told the agency to adopt those by rules. Another thing I pointed out about this specific grant of authority is that in the first line there of that section, you kind of laid out, you sort of put your thumb on the scale of what you want to happen with these rules. So you said that the purpose of these rules is to achieve maximum use of snowmobiles consistent with protection of the environment. So this is kind of giving a clue to the agency about what direction you want the rules to go. And that's an authorized way to regulate an agency's rulemaking use. Other ways that the legislature can impact the rulemaking process include enacting a law. So you can always repeal a rule, or you can supersede the rule by enacting something different by statute. So rules only exist to the extent that you authorize them, which also means that you have the authority to override them or repeal them if you want to. The LCC, as an entity, is authorized in statute to conduct investigations if they receive complaints about rules. The LCC and the GovOps Committee are both authorized in statute to file formal objections to rules. So if they receive complaints or have concerns about the rulemaking process, either of those committees is authorized to submit an objection. The objection goes to the agency itself, and they have an opportunity to respond. If the objection isn't withdrawn by those committees, then the objection gets published along with the rule, and then if the agency is later challenged about their rulemaking authority or the application of a rule, then the burden is on them to prove that the rule is proper. And the final authorization that might be more specifically relevant to this committee is that the substantive policy committee that has jurisdiction over an agency and its rulemaking can vote to delay application of a proposed rule. This has to happen in both the House and the Senate committees. But if you vote to delay a proposed rule, then that means that the rule won't apply until the end of the legislative session that happens after you took the vote. So if you voted to delay some sort of proposed rule that's, that the DNR is considering right now, it wouldn't go into effect until the end of the 2018 session. This slide just shows a few suggested questions that, that you know, members are often asking about rulemaking. They want to know, like, what should I be looking for, what should I be asking if an agency comes to me and says that they want rulemaking authority. So the first one that I'd highlight is just thinking about whether rulemaking is necessary or not. Sometimes you can put things that would normally go into rules into statute if you want to have a little bit more legislative direction on what the policy should be. But other times they might be asking for rulemaking authority because there's really a need for some technical expertise and assistance that you all don't necessarily have the time in committee to work through. So it's like the example is the snowmobile signage rules that I talked about earlier. So you're kind of balancing when you're granted rulemaking authority how much stuff you want to have in the statute versus how much stuff you want to have delegated to the agency. And for each topic, that is a different balancing test, and you can make a different judgment about that. How quickly the new policy needs to be implemented may affect what type of rulemaking you want to authorize for the agency. How much public input you want to have had want to have happen in the process also can affect what type of rulemaking you want to have, and then also the cost of the rulemaking. We talked a little bit earlier about what the variation in the costs. So how you want to address those costs can impact what type of rules you want to have adopted and whether you want to have rules adopted at all. So my last section here, my second to last section, is just a couple of slides about what happens when rulemaking appears to go wrong from your perspective. So I've got two slides here on sort of commonly asked questions from members about rulemaking when something happens that they don't like. So the first one here is the agency took some sort of action, they didn't adopt it by rules, what are my options to deal with that? There is a process in statute for a person to petition an agency, to petition the Office of Administrative Hearings to charge the agency with enforcing an unadopted rule. So in this, if this happens, then you go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, they have a hearing, they consider whether the agency is enforcing something that should have been adopted by rule or not. Often these types of issues come up when agencies do things like issue sort of internal guidelines or bulletins or manuals or policy directives, all sorts of words that you'd use to describe these kind of things that agencies do. Typically the test that the court is going to look at if there's a challenge to some sort of action by an agency as an unadopted rule is that they're going to be balancing whether the agency is sort of interpreting an existing rule or an existing statute without creating any new policy, or whether they're they've improperly adopted a new rule because they're setting new policy or enforcing it in a different way than they had previously. The other option that can happen is, in addition to this petition to the Office of Administrative Hearings, you can always challenge application of a rule in a more formal court setting. And then, as I've said several times, you all as a legislature can choose to supersede an action by an agency by adopting a law if you feel like the action by the agency was not appropriate. The second sort of common question that we get from members pretty frequently is that what do they do if the agency has adopted a rule that you don't like? What are your options in that case? Again, you can always supersede the rule by enactment of law, or you can repeal the rule. If you catch it in time, the governor also has veto authority over rules, so the governor can't veto a rule that's been adopted, but if it's still in the proposed stage, one of the last steps in the process is that the rules have to go to the governor for approval. So if you convince the governor that the rule should be vetoed, that's an authorization for you. You can challenge the application of the rule in court, so you can go into court and say, this rule, I don't like this rule because I think it's unconstitutional, or I think it exceeds our statutory authority, didn't comply with statutory rulemaking requirements. That's a process that exists for you. There's also an authorization for any individual to petition an agency to request a rule amendment or to repeal an amendment. This applies not just to you as legislators, but to members of the public as well. Agencies, when they get a petition like this for an amendment to a rule or repeal or required to sort of provide a detailed response to that request within 60 days to explain what they're going to do. Either they might agree with the petition and choose to amend the rule or repeal it, or they might explain in that detailed response why they're not going to do that. And then finally, Mr. Chair, the last little section here is sort of a sales pitch for a new feature of the Revised Set of Statutes website that some of you may know about, but is so far still a little bit unknown. Just in the last 6 months or year or so, the Revised has added this new feature on their website that allows you to track the rulemaking process. And I've got on the slides here just screen captures of what it looks like. I'm not tech savvy enough to know how to put on the internet and actually do it for you right now. But if you go through this website, what you can do is search by agency. And so in this slide deck that I have here, I just pulled up all the rules, the rulemaking procedures that are happening at the DNR right now. And it pulls up a list of all the rulemaking proceedings that have happened both currently and in the past. And you can see where they are in the process. So if you click through on these screens, what you can find is the list of the specific procedures in the rulemaking process that have happened, and then also click through and see those actual documents. So, for example, I talked about the SONAR document a little bit earlier. So this rule I've got up here is an emergency rule from the DNR related to chronic wasting disease. This one doesn't have a SONAR document, but you can click through and see the notices, see the different things that happened with that rule, and actually see the rule proposal itself. And it's a pretty convenient way to keep track of what's going on. So if you're interested in the rules from a particular agency or a particular type of rule, this website should be a pretty handy tool for you to use to keep track of what's going on. And, Mr. Chair, that's all I have for my presentation. I'm happy to take questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Mr. Guerin. It was very informative. We've got a couple of people on the list. I do have one question on your paper document, page 11 at the bottom slide. And then the final bullet point, voting to delay a proposed rule through House and Senate policy committees. I mean, does it need to move beyond that as well, then through both chambers and get a governor's signature?
Nope. Mr. Chair, the statute authorizes the delay of the rule if the substantive policy committees with jurisdiction over the rule vote to delay them. It only requires the vote of the committees. You do need the House and Senate committees to vote.
Right.
So it's not just one committee or the other. But there's no requirement in the statute that the delay be approved by the entire legislature.
Thank you. I just wanted a clarification. Next on the list is Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 6, slide at the top, the very last bullet point again, good cause, exempt rules must comply with separate special procedures, and it goes on a little bit. You had an example, Mr. Guerin.
Did I get that right?
I think you mentioned something in regard to ATV use and rules that were made. Could you give me a little bit more detail on that?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, so the good cause rulemaking is a special set of procedures in the statute where agencies can adopt rules without really much of a process. That usually happens when you've directed them to do a specific thing in statute. It also can happen if there's an emergency that needs to be addressed pretty quickly. There's an exception for serious threats to health, safety, or welfare. The ATV rules you're talking about, I don't have a whole lot of substantive knowledge about the rules themselves, but that is a section that was authorized in 2015, and you authorized in statute the agency to use good cause rulemaking to adopt in particular types of rules for ATV use, and then you set out in statute what the rules had to be. So there really wasn't a whole lot of discretion for the agency to set a policy themselves. You told them, this is the policy, this is what you want to write in the rule, and then they could use the good cause rulemaking to actually implement the rules in that way.
Thank you, Mr. Guerin. And to that point, Representative Heintzman, DNR is testifying next, and maybe they have a more specific answer to your question. Any follow-up? Okay. Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Guerin. This is helpful. I learned a lot today. In past years, we've heard about the need for both internal and external expertise being offered to the rulemaking process, and particularly around the question of peer-reviewed science. Can you help me understand, are there explicit expectations for that?
Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there's not a specific requirement in Chapter 14 about how science is used in the process, but it is something that when you have the open comment periods, people who are outside scientists can send in their comments on proposed rule, that, which it presumably could include their scientific conclusions. The same thing can also happen if there's a public hearing on a rule, so you could show up and say, you know, I disagree with the agency's scientific recommendations here, and this, you know, I think the rule should come out a different way based on this particular study, but it's not something that's directly addressed in the statute as it is currently.
Follow-up representative, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then with respect to internal science, is that explicit anywhere, you know, where there's expectations for the quality of the work? We hear challenges about the quality of the work of agencies with respect to its application of science to rulemaking.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yeah, there's nothing specific in the statute about how science is used in the rulemaking process, although the one note that I put in my notes here when I was going through the rules that would be of interest to you from the past couple years, in 2015 there's a wild rice rulemaking, there's a section that relates to wild rice water quality standards, and you sort of narrowed the scope of those standards until the agency adopted new rules that used a broader set of scientific reviews of those standards. So you can, in statute, direct an agency to consider outside studies or outside, you know, whatever research you want to have them use, but that's not something that's in the sort of default Chapter 14 procedures.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, on another area, that's costs, the costs of implementation of rules. There was a lot of discussion about that in the last session as well, and the public, you know, the value of the public understanding what would this cost to cities larger than 5,000 people, or cities that would have more than 10 employees, but just the cost of implementation. Is there any expectations in general to explain or to try to estimate costs of implementation of rules?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes. So there's the one section that does require agencies to certify whether they expect that compliance with the rules is going to cost either a small business or a small city more than $25,000. And if they do make that determination that it will cost that amount or more, then the small business or city can apply for one of these temporary exemptions from the rule. And then if they are granted that exemption, then they don't have to comply with the rule until after the legislature, until some future date when the legislature would approve the rule. So if the legislature doesn't approve the rule, then they would just be permanently exempt from having to comply.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my follow-up on that, is there any way for a city larger than that to at least to ask for an estimation of costs or to ask the agency to acknowledge the cost of the implementation?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there's not a specific procedure for that. There is a section that allows local governments to petition for a change in a rule if there's some new information that comes up that makes it apparent that there might be a less costly way of implementing a particular policy, or if there's some other less intrusive method of achieving a rule's purpose. So that process exists. It's not a specific cost process necessarily, but it's a way for local governments to say, hey, we, you know, you've adopted this rule and we found this other stuff that makes it clear that if we did it a different way, then it would be easier to implement or it would be less costly or there's just a better way of doing it. Local governments can petition an agency to amend a rule with that information. It doesn't require that the agency adopt that petition or adopt the rule or amend it in any way, but it is a process that local governments can use to kind of bring to light new information if they feel like it's important.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Yep. Representative Dundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering on page 4 of the handout here, it says on number 3, emergency DNR only. What constitutes an emergency? Who determines that? And can you give me an example of an emergency?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, so emergency rulemaking is only authorized to the extent that you all authorize the DNR to use that process, so it's kind of up to you to decide whether something's an emergency or not. Probably that term is a little bit of a loaded term because the types of rules that have been adopted using that process aren't necessarily, like, you know, what you'd normally think of as an emergency. So the agency staff can probably talk about this in more detail, but, for example, they just recently used that rulemaking process to set the spring turkey hunt dates for the spring. So, you know, it's a faster process for the agency to adopt rules that don't seem or have a sort of temporary application and don't need to go through the full-blown permanent rulemaking process. But deciding whether to use that process or not is really a decision for all of you as the legislature.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to my question and example.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, just in the last couple of months, the DNR has used the emergency rulemaking process to set rules that set the spring turkey hunt dates, so the open and close of that season. They also use the rules to they can use them to open or close specific areas of the state for hunting and fishing purposes. And then they are also authorized to use the rules in this emergency process to designate specific species as invasive species in Minnesota.
And to that point, Representative Sundin, the agencies are coming forward to testify today, too, so you could ask that of them as well. Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, for those of us who turkey hunt, that is an emergency, so I'm glad they did that. And it's kind of foreshadowing what you just said. I'd like, when the DNR comes down, to just kind of walk through the CWD, you know, how they do that in terms of time. During, I think they're on the agenda, but that might be a good way to see how quickly this could move, and maybe just a chronology of that on how quickly it moves and how that's why it's needed. That might be helpful.
And to that point, Representative Hansen, we are we're having a meeting next week, hopefully, on the CWD situation, and we are going to try to get out of here in 53 minutes, I believe. Anybody else? Okay. Yes, Representative Cornish.
Not that
I go by Dan, too. That's fine.
Not that this would ever happen, but if a state agency went rogue and violated the meaning and the intent of the rulemaking policy and tried to circumvent the legislature, do we have an emergency procedure? In other words, it looks like all we can do is pass a bill. If the governor won't sign it and the agency won't agree to amend it or have a hearing on it, what's our emergency procedure for putting the kibosh on it? There is there one.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, so the procedures that I think would exist for you would be, one, if it's still in a proposed rulemaking state, you can all, like I said, you can all vote to delay application of the rule. So you as the committee could say, the agency is moving forward with this rule. It's still in a proposed stage. We're going to vote to delay it so it doesn't apply to anyone until after a legislative session is done. So that's a way to slow it down. If the rule has been adopted, the two procedures you have are to either go through the court process, or you can challenge the rule as beyond the statutory authority of the agency to adopt that rule. And then the court would, as I talked about earlier, would do sort of this balancing test about whether the rulemaking authority was complied with or not. So that's a...
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cornish.
It seems what I take out of this is that over the 14 years that I've been here, when we continue, we're going to have to be very careful about the authority we give in rulemaking, considering what's happened to it over the last decades.
Thank you for those comments. And to that point, I think Mr. Gehring pointed out a couple of different things in here where you can go through the LCC, you can go through administrative hearings, and the administrative law judge to appeal some of these things as well. But very good question, very good point, and quite frankly, it's a part of the reason why we're having this hearing. So. Next on the list, thank you, Mr. Gehring. Appreciate your thoroughness here and your hard work. You do good stuff. Beth Carlson from Minnesota DNR is next on the list, and after Beth is going to be Michelle Beeman from MPCA. So would you come to the table, please? Ooh, Mr. Meyer's here, too. I saw your boss on the Lake of the Woods this weekend.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members.
Good morning.
Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. How was the fishing up there?
Well, when I ran into the commissioner late in the afternoon on Saturday, they had two walleyes laying on the ice. So there was more cans of Diet Coke inside of the fish house than there was walleyes on the ice. So
sounds like it was kind of slow, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I said Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner. I have with us our Rules Coordinator, Beth Carlson, to walk through our rulemaking procedures. And just to go back to Representative Sundin's questions about emergency rulemaking, Actually, as staff stated, emergency is kind of the wrong term for that rulemaking. It's the authority the legislature has given us to establish seasons and times or seasons and limits for deer, bear, walleye, things like that, special regulations. And most recently, as it was noted, we used this authority to establish the chronic wasting disease zones and taking of animals and things like that. And I can have Ms. Carlson walk through the timelines that was needed to establish that zone in a relatively quick fashion so we could get that hunt taken place. We do have a lot of different rulemaking authorities, as we discussed, and we use them quite regularly. When we do the good cause rulemaking exemption, and we need to get back to you on that ATV provision that you're looking for, we seek authority from the legislature, or in that case, it could have been a change that the legislature directed us in statute to do, and then we went and sought the good faith rulemaking exemption to update the rules that way. So it's stated very clearly in statute what the rule change is, and we just use the administrative process to update that rule. It is the most cost-effective and efficient way for us to do things, so you'll see that. We'll deal with that. From time to time, we'll be asking for that good cause rulemaking exemption or expedited permanent, things like that, to help us update the rules in a timely fashion. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Carlson just to walk through and give some examples of each of the rulemaking authorities that we have. And you also do have a copy of a report dated January 2013 that does contain all of our rulemaking authorities that's found in statute, the citations, and some of the sections that we've suggested repealing or that we are in the process of repealing as well. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll let Ms. Carlson take over.
And thank you for recognizing Representative Heintzman's question. I'm sure you'll get back to him on that ATV stuff. Ms. Carlson, identify yourself for the record and who you represent and proceed. And I will remind you that we are under a little bit of a time crunch here today, so if you could use some expedited testimony to move this along, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Elizabeth Carlson. I am a strategic planning and policy administrator at the Department of Natural Resources. One of my responsibilities is managing the department's portfolio of rulemaking activities as rules coordinator. There should be four handouts in your packet in addition to that agency report on rules, which was a required report to the legislature back in January 2013. Also is a fact sheet on DNR agency rulemaking. I'll be referring to that during my remarks, as well as a copy of our annual report. As the previous presenter just mentioned, I'll also be referring to that. On that are listed several examples that link to that website that he mentioned in the revisor's database, which is a wonderful resource for all of you. There are links there to the examples that I'll be referring to of rules that we completed last year of exempt and expedited rulemaking done under the Administrative Procedure Act, Chapter 14. And also there is a copy of our current rulemaking docket in your packet as well of the current permanent rules we're working on. I want to ground this in the definition of truly emergency rulemaking authority that changed in 1995, which was the last time that Chapter 14 was overhauled. The 1995 legislature at that time, as part of that overhaul, repealed the authorities for game and fish and other emergency rulemaking that were in Chapter 14 and moved all of that language whole into Chapters 84 and 97A. The authorities that allow us to do our expedited emergency and emergency rulemaking and exempt fisheries permanent rulemaking that we still do to this day. We were doing it before. Those authorities were in the Administrative Procedure Act, and all of that language was simply moved into the natural resources laws, simply changed locations. They were rulemaking then, and they're still rulemaking today. The DNR also at that time converted its previous system of commissioner's orders that we were using at that time for fish and wildlife activities into legislation and rules in order to increase public input for and awareness of the regulations. We still do some commissioner's orders. We still have about 50 specific statutory authorities for some commissioner's orders that we still do to this day. The intended purpose of emergency rulemaking as it still exists is to allow the agency temporary regulatory authority until permanent rules can be done, but it's very rarely used as purely emergency rulemaking. emergency rulemaking, as we use the term, may only be used for a 180-day period, about 6 months, and renewed once. DNR has used that emergency process just three times in the last 20 years, in 1994 and 2004 relating to invasive species, and in 1999 to close certain lakes to harvest following rehabilitation of those lakes. So it was used to put in some temporary regulations until we could get the permanent rules done, because doing full permanent rulemaking takes time and a lot of participatory work with the public in order to get the full permanent rules done, as you heard described in the previous presentation. Now, the adaptation of that emergency rulemaking process is what we call expedited emergency rulemaking. Now, part of the reason I'm giving this presentation is to sort out all of these terms. Emergency rulemaking, expedited emergency rulemaking, expedited permanent rulemaking. It all gets very confusing because those words get used a lot repeatedly, and that's why we've got this fact sheet for you. It's to help you sort that out. The first page is an overview of our DNR rulemaking. The second page is a chart of expedited and exempt rulemaking that DNR uses under Chapter 14, the Administrative Procedures Act. The third page is a chart that I had to create for myself when I was starting to do this to help me keep track of all of this, and I thought you would find it very useful as well. It's a list of all of the different rulemaking procedures that are available to the department. The color coding is there to help you, but also I've got it listed in text. For the blue ones are the ones that got moved into the natural resources laws, the DNR laws, the authorities for expedited emergency rulemaking and emergency rulemaking and the exempt fisheries rulemaking. I'll describe what those are, that we use that are unique to DNR. And then the ones in green are the ones that are under the Administrative Procedures Act. And I'm going to explain these, but I've got these here for you to refer to. There are slight differences among these, and I'm going to describe the differences. So back to my notes. The expedited emergency rulemaking that Bob referred to is for game and fish. It's a rulemaking process that we use under conditions that don't allow the commissioner to comply with the requirements for emergency rulemaking. It's an adapted process. Rules are effective for up to 18 months, and we use that process mainly for hunting and fishing rules that need to be set each season, year after year, and for species that need rapid handling, species rules that need rapid handling. For example, every year the DNR gathers data for certain game species on a yearly basis, and analyze the data in order to set appropriate bag limits, season dates, hunting zones, and so forth. And it's also used for those special circumstances like disease management when things pop up. For example, with those the chronic wasting disease situation, I didn't even know we were going to do that rulemaking until it had already popped up in southeastern Minnesota and it had hit the news and the news release was out there and I saw that news release and that's when I knew we were going to have to do a very quick rulemaking. And it was between about the time when everybody was hearing about that, about a month of time when we put those rules together, that we got that entire rulemaking done and filed with the Secretary of State and reviewed, got its legal review and all the proper language put together and published in the State Register and in place, probably in the space of, I would say, 4 to 6 weeks. Now, we did that one maybe a little faster than usual for those. We usually like to have about 6 to 8 weeks to get these expedited emergency rules done. So that we're not absolutely frantic in getting them done. We can get them done faster, as with disease management, if we have to.
Ms. Carlson, yes. Representative Green, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could have waited, but the one question I had is just when you brought up that you put the expedited and emergency rules from Chapter 14 to 84, was there a reason for that? Does that separate now out the DNR anything special from the other agencies?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this I only know from looking back into the historical records because it was before my time with the DNR. My understanding was at the time in 1995 as things were being cleaned up and reworked in the Chapter 14 at that time. At that time, former Commissioner Merriam was Senator Merriam at that time and was helping to lead that effort. And he saw a need to keep that authority for DNR to keep be able to continue to do those seasonal rules using that procedure. And it's my understanding that he helped to guide that effort to move that language over into the natural resources law to keep that authority for the DNR. That is my anecdotal understanding of how that happened.
Representative Green, follow up.
Mr. Chair, I guess that doesn't really explain to me why it was moved, because didn't they have the authority in the Chapter 14 already? What was the point of moving it specifically over to the DNR?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's my understanding that if that hadn't happened, it would have been repealed entirely and we would have lost the authority.
Representative Green, we may require a little more in-depth looking at some.
Yeah, I'm not going to take up any more time on that, but I would like to know that, because why did they repeal it for the other agencies? Because obviously other agencies had it. They didn't. Deputy Commissioner Myers could answer it, that's fine. Otherwise, I can wait till I get.
And I would also suggest Mr. Gehring is still here. Maybe you could set up a meeting with him and you two could talk about that. He may be able to give you some background on that. Is that correct? I see a head nodding up there. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Okay, we need to move on. And thank you. And by the way, we're going to change our schedule here a little bit. Mike Hannon, you'll be up next. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, should I continue?
Please, yes. You got about 3 minutes.
All right. The DNR also does exempt permanent fisheries rules for the designation of experimental and special management waters. This was another authority that was moved over into the game and fish law. An example of that would be the designation of trout, streams, and lakes using that process. These are also rules that we do under procedures that are in our natural resources laws now, and those are also filed as rules with the Secretary of State and published in the State Register. We also use, the procedures for exempt and expedited rulemaking, as you see on page 2 in the handout in the fact sheet, and we have examples of those in our, annual report to the legislature. We have the exempt permanent rulemaking process. We used two versions of that in the last year. We had an exempt permanent rule relating to prohibited and regulated invasive species, which were technical corrections. We published a notice of intent on that, and which did not require us to offer a hearing under the authority that we were given by the legislature. And we also had an exempt permanent rule relating to taking fish on waters bordering adjacent state. Our authority for that was granted to us by the legislature did require us to offer a hearing. We did not receive anywhere near the required threshold for, in fact, we didn't receive any requests for hearing on that one, although we did have to offer a hearing, and that was also successfully concluded. Both of those examples are there, and you can look those up in the revisor's status database. We also do good cause exempt rules, and our main use of that good cause exemption is to amend rules to conform with statutory changes in session laws. This is a process that favors email notice because the comment period is only 5 days from the date that we send those to the administrative law judge. It's highly unusual for this rulemaking process to draw much comment because we're simply conforming our rules to match the changes in the session law, and we had two examples of those last year as well. In closing, I'd just like to say that the department places a high value on consulting with the public. Much of our rulemaking is informed by our ongoing interactions and relationships with a widely varied and active citizenry and business community, and our objectives for rulemaking are to be guided by both science and informed by public participation, and to go about it in a responsive and responsive manner, using the most efficient process that's appropriate to the subject matter and its public policy context. So I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Questions, members? Now, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Ms. Carlson, I noticed in Chapter 6115, your public waters resources rulemaking, that the DNR requires fees and permits for underground gas and liquid storage. Do you overlap with the PCA on those permits and costs, and if so, why?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with the details of that particular statutory authority. That's something we'd have to look back up and get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, you know, frequently what happens with two agencies, you can get this overlap, and it's certainly a burden on anybody that's looking for permits. So, yes, if you could get back to me, I'd appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions, members? Thank you for being here, both of you, and I'm sure we'll continue this discussion at another time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Hannon, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Hannon,
I'm sorry. I'm a FIAD teacher. Mr. Hannon, thank you for being here and taking time out. I know the roads were probably a little treacherous for you, but we appreciate you being here, and we moved you up on the agenda because you came the furthest, and I know about coming far. So state your name for the record and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mike Hannon. I'm the Solid Waste Administrator for Otter Tail, Todd, and Wadena Counties in West Central Minnesota. I'm also the Executive Director for the Prairie Lakes Municipal Solid Waste Authority, which represents the counties of Becker, Clay, Otter Tail, Todd, and Wadena. My reason for being here today might be slightly different than the agencies, as in what I had hoped to talk about some was the importance of rules to counties and other permittees. I'm going to try to limit my discussion to counties, although in a lot of cases I think what I have to say may be relevant to other permittees as well. Our group of counties, we operate eight transfer stations, six demolition landfills, municipal waste combustor ash landfill, and a municipal solid waste landfill. So you see that we're intimately involved with the permitting process and rules. What I had hoped to do was talk a little bit about how we got from where we are to how we got to where we're at today. I'll pass on that because I know that you have some time constraints, but from a county perspective, you know, we take our responsibilities for managing solid waste very, very seriously. You know, statutorily, we're responsible for providing alternatives for waste management to the residents in our counties, and that ranges anywhere from public education to recycling facilities to providing some landfill opportunities as well. In our case, in rural Minnesota, west central Minnesota, a lot of times the county option is the only option that's out there. So from our perspective, we look at those facilities and we say, if that facility wasn't there, our county's residents don't have an option other than miles and miles away. Over the years, we have had a lot of interaction with the state agencies specifically related to solid waste, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We believe we have a good working relationship with the agency, and we really value the expertise that they provide to us in our area. But one of the things that we've seen happen over the years is, if you look at the landfill-specific rules, you know, they came into play in the late 1980s. The rules were adopted. There's been little change in those rules since the 1980s. County staff, agency staff, began to recognize, probably spearheaded by the closed landfill program in the mid-90s, that the rules as they existed didn't really apply well to anything other than the municipal waste landfills. In our counties, we operate several demolition landfills, and as the municipal waste landfills began to close, we in turn were having to look at how those demo landfills could fill in the stopgap for the municipal waste landfills. And one of the things that began to happen is we looked at ways to fit those facilities into the rules that existed. And a lot of times that's done by administrative policy. Sometimes it's done by just language that's written into a permit. And from a county perspective, that's really hard to deal with. You know, agency staff will sit down with them, we'll go over what our facilities are, what our needs are, and we'll get some direction from them on where we're headed with that. But then you get down to the process of actually having to issue a permit, and we find that there's some changes that we need to address. You know, during that process, counties have hired private consulting firms. We individually don't have the expertise to do some of these things. So we hire consulting firms at great expense to the counties. And in the long run, we find out that we have to take a step back and start over again. And that gets real expensive. So from the perspective of looking at where we go from here, and I know your real focus is to look at rulemaking procedures, but from a county perspective, those rules are really important to us. And it's important that we have clear rules available to us, because the regulation by permit or regulation by policy gets to be very difficult to deal with. From a county perspective, we're looking at a couple of areas. You know, one I mentioned is that we look at our responsibilities with waste management, but we also look at dealing with the communities that we live in and trying to make sure that we don't have issues that take place, whether it's illegal disposal, illegal dumping. We have to address those issues as well. Counties have spent several different times in rulemaking processes with the MPCA and staff, and I believe the staff, the agency, are probably as frustrated as counties with the way those things go. You know, we've started rulemaking. We've never gotten it completed. Probably the closest thing we got to it was in 2005, where not to the greatest desire of all of us, we basically developed a guidance document. And we all know guidance isn't rule and guidance isn't statute. But it appeared really likely that we were not going to come to an agreement on terms for the rules and the guidance document. And I encourage everybody to take a look at it, because it really did lay out in a lot of good terms how we move forward with managing these demolition landfills over that period of time. But again, it's not rules. So from a county perspective, and I'm going to keep trying to be brief here, you know, from our perspective, you know, we live out there. We have a desire to protect the environment, but we also have a desire to address the socioeconomic needs of our communities. And I think if you look at the guidance document, that really is identified in the guidance document, that there's environmental rules, and then there's the need to address the socioeconomic requirements that are in those communities. Again, in the interest of time, I don't want to go back through some of the things that were done in those rules but are in the guidance document, but some of them were very good. One of the probably downfalls to it is there was some real clear-cut direction given to all of us in how we gathered information about the facilities over, you know, that guidance document was really supposed to be a stopgap for kind of a 1 to 2 year permit cycle, so a 5 to 10 year period of time. And we probably didn't do as good a job either from an agency perspective or a permittee perspective of looking at what we were learning about those facilities as they were moving forward. And now what we've really come to is the end of those permit cycles, those 5 and 10 year cycles, and those permits are expiring, and now we're kind of having a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction to what do we do now? Those permits are expiring. How do we deal with them? And some of that's coming out of individual permits. If I had more time, I could talk about some of our individual facility permits, but things being written into the permits, things being done through policy that really make it difficult for us to deal with, and again, as counties or probably even as other permittees. So in closing, I just really want to say, you know, counties, we're very interested in continuing our work with the state agency staff. We're very interested in protecting the environment of the areas we live in, but we really want and need to be able to consider all of the aspects of managing the waste in our region, and we cannot continue to do that by reacting to individual permits or policies as they go along. So I know your meeting was really intended to discuss the procedures and policies for developing these, but I just want to talk briefly today about how important those rules can be to the regulated community. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hainan. And this is a very, very big issue for members who live in rural Minnesota. You know, if you've had one-tenth of the conversations that I've had with people about the demo landfills and the renewal of permits and so forth. This is a critical issue in rural Minnesota. To think that people are going to haul demo landfill 130 miles one way, I don't find that as a solution to a problem. In fact, I think what it's going to do is wind up causing a problem, because holes are going to be dug places and this stuff is going to be disposed of, and then we are going to have some real serious problems. In my district in Roseville County, you know, we have a closed landfill up there, and the perception of our county and city officials is that our demo landfill is being held to a higher standard than the state-owned or state-run closed landfill. So, Mr. Hainan, how many demo landfills are there in rural Minnesota in particular?
There's like 110 total. I don't know how many of those are in rural Minnesota, but a good percentage of them are.
And you said that many permits have been reapplied for. I'm not exactly sure what the correct terminology is for that. And this has been going on, I believe, for 2 years, I think you said.
Well,
that's in my mind.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
My question then becomes, how many of those permits have been now reissued?
I'm not sure I can directly answer that, but very few of them, really.
If any.
I know in our case we have three applications in for the six facilities we have. One has gone through the public notice period. The others have been submitted, you know, in 2015 and 16, and they haven't been reissued or even commented on.
And Mr. Hainan, the comment that I hear in this permitting process that counties are going through is that the target is moving. You one day you think you've got it, and then the target moves, and then the permit application is sent back. You have further discussions with MPCA. So my question for you is, you know, you talked about statute, rules, and guidance documents. Do you feel like MPCA is following statute, rules, and more specifically the guidance documents with regards to reissuing permits?
Mr. Chairman, members, the short answer to that is no. The longer answer would be, you know, that for at least the last 10 years, probably longer, we have submitted permit applications. There's a checklist in the requirements on how we submit those applications. But for those 10 years, we've been looking at the rules and the interpretation of the rules that existed has existed for many years, and we've looked at the guidance document and assume that's what our permit reissuance documents would be based on. What's happening is they get to the state agency, to the PCA, and the agency has looked at some of the other rules and said that they feel that there's parts of those rules that are more important than maybe the rules that we have always looked at as the demo landfill rules. And certainly the guidance document, we've actually been told the guidance document is just that, it's a guidance document. But we've been using it for 10 years, and that's the kind of the concern that we have, is we submitted all those applications based on the rules that we've always gone under and that guidance document, and now we're looking at different sets of rules to say they override these rules.
And Mr. Hainan, and my point would be is we haven't gone through rulemaking.
We have not, and we've suggested it, and I don't know that the agency's opposed to it, but we really haven't gotten there. And we've done a couple of processes like that in the past, previous to 2005, and we just never got the rules adopted. And if I'd had a little time, I would have explained how we got from the 1988 rules to where we're at today with demo landfills. But
thank you. Representative Wagenius, question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to make sure I'm getting this correct. What you are asking for is rules for permit for demolition landfills that have been promulgated and that you all can use. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Hainan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, I think that summarizes it very well. I think what we're either saying is we've operated under this set of rules and this guidance document for the last 10 years. If we're going to change away from that now, it has to be through rulemaking and direct, clear direction from the state agency on what those rules are going to be.
Representative Wagenius, follow-up, please.
Yes, thank you. Well, one of the things that, and I would agree with you, so I think every the agency should have rules. The thing I'm kind of weighing in my mind is that when we did the closed landfill bill, it was because the landfills were leaking all sorts of toxic things into people's into the groundwater, which is people's drinking water. So when I hear about the demolition in different parts, I mean, I hear your area, and I hear your area. I know you're very sandy, Wadena and Otter Tail have lots of problems with drinking water. And I suspect that your area is very different underneath, and you don't have lots of problems with drinking water. So I am wondering, and this is a question for both you guys and the agencies, how do you do rules for demolition landfills when some of the areas are vulnerable, yours, and some of them aren't, which would be in yours? And I just don't know the answer to that, and I think that's the answer we need to hear from you and from the agency. If that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Mr. Hanen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, you're very perceptive. Actually, Otter Tail County falls right into a transition zone where you can find either real heavy clay soils or sand. You move a little to the north and east, Wadena, those areas, there's a lot of sand in those areas. I think what I'm saying is the rulemaking process would be a process that develops that the answer to that question. And how do we address those? You know, right now we have some information that's been developed over the last 10 years on what's happening at those demo landfills that we didn't have 10 years ago. But I think from a county perspective and a permitting perspective, we're saying now we need to spend some time understanding what that means and then write that into whatever rules move forward after that time.
Okay. Hey, Representative Wagenius, if I may interject, I can. I'm the chair. I would say that to your point, one of the things that has generated conversation, I'll say, amongst the people that talk to me and others is the fact that oftentimes the rules are promulgated and it's put into a box and one size fits all. And we need to somehow figure out a way, you know, you talk about Wadena County and Rosa County, and we go up to Kuchijin County, and things are, you know, a lot different. So that's one of the issues that, one of the reasons why this hearing is here is because one size doesn't fit all. And as Mr. Hanen says, you are very perceptive. Thank you for that. Any follow-up, Representative Wagenius?
No, but, you know, it might be interesting at some point for us to have a geology lesson about this state, because what is in my area and in what is in his area and what your area and your area, so different. That's the thing that has just, and I can't say that I understand it all, only understand that this state has the most diverse geology probably of any state in the nation.
And Representative Wagenius, I would suggest if we go through that, the agencies do too. And with that, Representative Hansen.
Well, this is kind of fascinating because I heard something completely different from the testifier. I heard that rules are good, that they need to be updated, and they need to include the current science. So if we're finding out that groundwater contamination is occurring, I think there are people who don't want that to happen, like people with private wells who are going to have to replace them because they're adjacent to groundwater. So I think that's what you were saying, is that updating rules with current science is good, but then we get into the issue of if you do that, then you have one size fits all versus a cookie cutter. So you can't have both. You can't have a cookie cutter versus one size fits all, because if you have the rules that are updated, exactly as Representative Wagenius said, there are areas of the state that are more susceptible to contamination. So if there are areas that are more susceptible to contamination, then they may need stricter rules.
Mr. Hanen.
Mr. Chairman.
You're going in a circle.
I think you're right in what I was saying. I think that I was saying that the rules need to be looked at. I think we're also saying that that if you look at that history that I was going to talk about. You know, some of those landfills were developed since 2005. The 2005 guidance document had some very, very restrictive definitions of what could be accepted at Class 1 demo landfills. There's very few of those Class 1 demo landfills, if you look at them, that aren't either adjacent to a previous facility or even a closed landfill. So I think from a permittee perspective, we're really saying it'd be nice to take a look at some of those that only took those materials that could have been accepted during that period of time and see what's happening at those facilities and then use some of that information to develop the rules as we move forward. And the one size probably can't fit all, and that was the socioeconomic discussion. You know, you get some of the demo landfills, you know, if you look at the ones out out our direction, you know, one that takes 6,000 to 8,000 cubic yards a year is considered a big landfill. You get up in the northern part of the state, and I know of some that take 200 cubic yards to 1,000 cubic yards of demo in a whole year, but that's their local alternative. So monitoring and some of those things may have to play into those facilities, and we certainly would not purport to support a one-size-fits-all.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be real brief. Not want to put words in Mr. Heyman's mouth, but I guess from my perspective and what I hear from my county folks, there's an issue with where the rules aren't clear. They may be outdated. They may not incorporate the newest information. That then bleeds over into the permitting process, and so you almost end up with this micro-permitting process that becomes a rules process that really causes delay, extra cost, and a lot of issues. And so I guess you didn't say it, but I've been told by a number of people in the same business you are, very specifically, we go too far sometimes in the permitting process, almost as if we're going to make rules for that specific landfill, and it's not clear. Maybe information in the guidance document, not in the rules, and at a minimum it delays and certainly is expensive. So we've got work to do in this area. I'll just say that.
Thank you, Representative Blue. Mr. Hayden, thank you very much for taking time to come down here today. We really appreciate it, and if there's something that we can do to help you in this, pick up the phone or send me an email or stop into my office or your members here. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Mr. Daniel Marks, would you please come down? Remember, members, we are going to adjourn at 9:50. So it was nice. Representative Hansen said he would try to keep his questions down over here, and I said, well, I'm trying to do that to myself. So.
Good morning, Mr.
Proceed. Identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Daniel Marks. I am an attorney with the law firm of Flaherty and Hood, and I principally practice in municipal and environmental law, and I represent a host of greater Minnesota cities on environmental matters, particularly with wastewater permitting issues. And I also work on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, or MESRB, which is a joint powers organization of about 45 cities in greater Minnesota, cities, sanitary districts, and public utilities commissions. And the focus of that organization is really to work with the agency during the rulemaking process to make sure that municipal concerns are addressed, that the water quality standards and rules that affect wastewater permitting are based on sound science, and that the limited amount of resources, both at the local and the state level, that are allocated towards clean water efforts are used efficiently and effectively. And today I just want to talk about a couple of kind of overarching concerns about the rulemaking process that we have from the municipal perspective. And I think that as you heard today from the beginning presentation, the main purpose of the rulemaking process in the Administrative Procedures Act is to guarantee the public due process. And the fundamental component of due process is the notice and the opportunity to be heard. And I think especially in the last year or two, municipalities have noticed that the Pollution Control Agency has really done a very good job at engaging with local governments and bringing us into the process at an early stage and really increased their efforts at that level, and we're appreciative of that, and that's very important in the rulemaking process. I think our concern goes to the distinction between being listened to and being heard, and that often during the rulemaking process and the public comment period, we will raise legitimate scientific, technical, and legal concerns about proposed rules or proposed actions by the agency. And our experience is that we often do not get a substantive response to those concerns, and that it is very difficult for us, when raising those concerns, to have a meaningful impact on the rulemaking process, the rules themselves. And so I just want to take a few moments to just talk about a few areas in the rulemaking process where we have some specific issues that we have identified that can kind of assist municipalities in this process. The first is just making sure that there is enough time. A lot of these rulemakings involve very complicated scientific and legal issues, and the municipal entities do not have the same budgets for technical consultants and advocates as some of the private industry groups and some of the environmental advocacy organizations. And so it's really important from the municipal perspective that there is sufficient time for us in rulemaking to have to review those documents, to really digest the science and what the agency is proposing to do and how it will impact us. So time is an important component. The second piece for us is that this rulemaking process, the development of the sonar and kind of the background documents about the development of the rule and the interpretation of the rule really sets the framework for us going forward. So it helps us initially understand what the agency intends to do and how they intend to implement it. One of the concerns that we have is that often the agency will pronounce a certain implementation plan during rulemaking and then will later change that plan through guidance documents, as the gentleman previously was talking about, without putting those guidance documents through notice and public comment. And sometimes the changes in those guidance documents are substantive and significant and impact us, and when those changes happen without notice and public comment procedures, we don't have the opportunity to weigh in. The fourth piece, is really looking at external independent peer-reviewed science during the rulemaking process. Currently, under Minnesota Statute 15035, external independent peer review is discretionary for the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. The rulemaking process says if the commissioner doesn't convene an independent external peer review, then they must state why, but it does not require that. And we think a lot of issues that we see as municipalities could be addressed on the front end if there was more independent external peer-reviewed science during agency rulemaking. Next is the administrative rule process often will go to a hearing before an administrative law judge. That hearing, they will take comments from a host of the public and the regulated community. And we often find that it is difficult to really get our technical, scientific, and legal issues to be addressed in that process. Often, we have administrative law judges who are dealing with very complicated areas of the law, very complicated scientific issues that they have never dealt with before. And we find that the legal process provides the administrative law judges with an opportunity to give far more deference to the agency than they often deserve on some of the scientific and legal interpretation components of their rulemaking. And so that's something that we often are concerned with and struggle with. A lot of times the agency science is seen as gospel when our independent expert science is not necessarily heard with the same weight. And then finally, as Representative Johnson raised, and others as well, the cost impact. A very important component of the rulemaking process is the agency is required in law to analyze the costs to a host of entities. Our principal concern is costs to municipalities, local governments, and then the state itself of agency rules. As you're all aware, the EPA estimates that there is roughly an $11 billion water infrastructure need in Minnesota. one of the things that we would like to see on a regular basis is that as the agency proposes a new rule, that they take a very comprehensive look at the cost of that rule on municipalities and how it will impact the state budget through the funding mechanisms of the PFA and other infrastructure funding programs. And this is a concern because we recognize as local governments that we, at the local level and at the state level, we only have a certain amount of money to do this very important work to clean and protect our water. We want to make sure that the agency is being transparent with the public, with legislators, about how that money is being used so that we can weigh in and say, is this the right way to use that those funds? A recent example of this is in the wild rice sulfate standard, where the agency listened to many of our concerns, and they have convened a very comprehensive, they brought in outside consultants to do a comprehensive cost and feasibility analysis about municipalities treating for sulfate to protect wild rice. One of the issues, however, is that study won't be complete in time for the public rulemaking process, or at least it's not slated to be complete. And so that was a concern of ours that we raised with the agency. So to conclude, I think that from our perspective as municipal entities, that the agency has really improved in the last 2 years to really work with us, engage us at an early stage, but we think that there is a lot of work to be done going forward to make sure that this process is effective and efficient and that ultimately we come out with rules that the regulated community is confident in, and that the agency is confident in, and that the public is confident in, so that we are sure that we are using those limited resources most effectively to clean and protect water. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And with that, I will conclude my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Just real quickly, you talked about the administrative law judge and the science and the deference and so forth. In Mr. Gehring's presentation, he also mentioned that there's the Office of Administrative Hearings, and then also the LCC. Have you taken your case to those entities as well?
Yes.
Okay. And what response do you get there?
It is a response where we will, like I said, we'll have the opportunity to bring our concerns and to be listened to, or to be, present our issues, but we often feel that the substantive concerns just simply go unaddressed.
Thank you. Representative Metza, you're first on the list, and we have Wagenius and Clark, and we'll be adjourning here in about 3 minutes, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just make a comment, no need for response, but I appreciate my colleagues on both sides of the aisle and the bipartisan effort to make sure that the most current science was used and followed, and would just echo a little bit of what our testifier had said and hope that, all science can be peer-reviewed and replicated if the state is implementing it.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. One, you talk about administrative law judges not having the expertise you think they need. It used to be that administrative law judges would focus in a certain area, so they would have an expertise. So I think it would be important for us to figure out why that's not the case anymore, if it's not the case. But secondly, in your fifth point about the cost impact, and I'm thinking about drinking water again right here, municipalities are often charged with getting things out of their drinking water that they had no, they didn't put in, and the folks who are living in that area were not responsible for what's getting into the water. And in that case, I actually think the state does have a responsibility to help those municipalities. And maybe that is something, Mr. Chair, that we can look at.
Sure. All right. Thank you. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be real straight. You may have partly answered the question, but so I'm just wondering, since you didn't get what you needed in terms of the wild rice review, what would it take? Are we talking about just more resources? There's an outline of the different places to go, but is it an issue of more resources for the agency?
Mr. Marks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark. I only wanted to use the wild rice example as kind of an example, but generally speaking, I think from the municipal perspective, like I said initially, we have our perspective is that a lot of these standards get developed with a lot of pressure from well-funded private industry and well-funded environmental advocacy organizations, and the municipalities are kind of caught in the middle often. And so one way that I think that could improve the process from our perspective is having that independent review, independent scientific review built in. And so it's less of this person's hired gun and this person's hired gun trying to fight about science.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Okay, members, just real quickly here, and Representative Clark, I apologize if I'm cutting you off. We've got to move. We'll have MPCA here tomorrow to finish their portion of this discussion. Then we'll do the Bowser overview, and we'll have the Wetland Bank closure update. And then we're going to move something that's very near and dear to me, the Section 404 Assumption Report. We're going to move that to another later date. I don't think we'll have time to get through that. It could be very time-consuming. Questions real quickly? With that, we're adjourned.